Welcome to the Bay Area Book Festival's Writer to Writer podcast series, featuring a conversation between two prominent writers who are big fans of each other's work. This is Sherilyn Parsons, director of the festival. Enjoy the program.
Right next to me is Essie Adugin. She's the author of the novels Washington Black, The Second Life of Samuel Tyne, and Half-Blood Blues. Both Washington Black and Half-Blood Blues were finalists for the Man Booker Prize. Both of these novels also won the Scotiabank Giller Prize. She has also published a book of nonfiction, Dreaming of Elsewhere, Observations on Home, and she lives in Victoria, British Columbia. Seated next to her, Tayari Jones. She is the author of four novels, including Leaving Atlanta, The Untelling, Silver Sparrow, and An American Marriage. An American Marriage was the 2018 Oprah's Book Club selection. The novel was also awarded an NAACP Image Award and the Aspen Words Prize. Jones is a member of the Fellowship of Southern Writers. She's been the recipient of the Hurston Wright Legacy Award and an NEA Fellowship. Oh, and she's a professor of creative writing at Emory University in Atlanta. All right. So I would love it if we could start out with the two of you talking about the genesis of your latest novels and how you came to settle on the story you chose to tell.
Okay, I guess I'll start. So I had originally thought I was working on an entirely different novel, which often happens with me. I start in one place and then find myself just going in so many different directions. But I thought I was doing a novel about the Tichborne Claimant series of trials, which was, I guess a whole series of suits and countersuits and perjury trials that went on in 1860s England for almost 30 years. And those trials centered around the disappearance of a man called Roger Tichborne, who was a 25-year-old aristocrat from the south of England who was shipwrecked off the coast of Argentina. But his mother refused to believe that he'd died, so she reached out to clairvoyant, who told her that her son was still alive and living in, in a sun-filled land far away. So she reached out into... She put notices in newspapers all around the world and got a response from Australia from a butcher claiming to be her son. And she was overjoyed and immediately knew that this was him. But just in case it wasn't, and realizing that her, the family at large might not get on board with this, she wrote a letter to one of their servants who had retired to Sydney, Australia, and asked him to travel out to this small town that the butcher lived in to see if it was indeed her son. And the man that she reached out to was called Andrew Bogle, and he was an ex-slave who'd been stolen off a plantation in the Caribbean by a member of the Tichborne household 40 years earlier. And he worked in their employ for all that time and traveled all around England as a valet to Sir Edward Tichborne. And then when Sir Edward died, he retired to Australia with his sons. But I thought I would tell the story of those trials through Bogle's eyes and quickly came to realize that I was far less interested in all of the endless reversals of these trials than I was in the actual psychology of a man who was like Bogle, but who wasn't Bogle himself. Somebody who had been raised in a place of great brutality with a sense of his life being, defined by cruelty and being a very finite thing, something that would...
I am Kai Milner. I'm going to be your moderator for this event.
In a savage way, to be taken out of that that sense of yourself and the sense of a lack of possibilities into a world where you were, you know, slightly less restricted and, you know, seeing things that were so different from everything else that you'd ever known. And that was my story.
You know, it's funny. I often start writing a novel that I think is what I'm going to write, and it ends up not being... I almost think of it like when I finish a book, I'm so eager to start another book that I just jump into another project. I almost think of it like in love, like when you end a relationship, you jump into like that rebound relationship, and you're like, this is it. Oh, no, that's not it. Okay. So by the time I started An American Marriage, I had done with the rebound novel, and I decided I wanted to write and engage the issue, an issue of the day. My other novels had been more involving my autobiography. Like I wrote Silver Sparrow as a gift to my sister. I have a sister. We have the same father. We weren't reared together, and I wanted to write a book to her to let her know that she's my sister in my heart always. So I wrote that one, and then I said, well, maybe now I need to write outside of myself to try to engage the issues of the day. So I wanted to do something involving the issue of mass incarceration. And so I wrote a fellowship application to go to Harvard to learn more about incarceration. I knew I was interested in wrongful incarceration, and I did all this research, and I learned so much about the way that the United States treats its imprisoned population. I learned statistics that would keep you up at night. One that keeps in my mind is that 1 out of 4 black men in Washington, D.C. will go to prison or in jail. And I learned how much money it costs people, probation, bail, parole. It's fueling a whole industry. I was outraged, but I wasn't inspired to write a novel. I was angry, but inspiration and anger are not the same thing. I suppose one can lead to another, but in my case, I was getting just stuck on rage, and I didn't know what to do. The people at Harvard wanted us to give a presentation of our work, and I had been working, but I didn't have any work. I just had like this stack of really angry index cards. A copy of the New Jim Crow that I had read it so much I had broken the spine, the pages were falling out. I was going through it like a deck of cards. But that's not a novel. Because a novel, for it to work, a novel has to be about people and their problems, not problems and their people. And I had a problem. I didn't have any people. So I went home to Atlanta to visit my mama, which is something I do when I have things on my mind. And while I was there, I went to the mall, which is something else I do when I have things on my mind. It is very helpful. But while I was there, I heard a couple arguing. I heard the woman say, clear as a bell, she said, Roy, you know you wouldn't have waited on me for 7 years. And I looked at her, she looked at me, I looked at him, we all looked at each other. And I felt like we all knew he would not have waited on her for no 7 years. But then he turned and looked at her and said, I don't know what you're talking about, because this wouldn't have happened to you in the first place. And for me, I know that I have what I need for a novel when I have a situation where the characters disagree, but they're both right.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about what Tayari just said, which is, you know, it's very clear from your book that there's a ton of research in it, but it kind of melts away into the characters. And so I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the research you did and how much you knew to put in and how much you knew to put out and when you knew to let the story take over.
Yeah, I mean, I think you could research forever. And in fact, it's one of these great procrastination tricks that you say, I'm just going to have a research day, you know, and you just... This goes on for a week that you're just sitting there reading, and you can convince others that you're, you know, this is the hard work that you're doing, but you have to eventually get to your desk. I started researching this novel like a full year before I started writing it. I was very pregnant at the time with my son, and felt that this was exactly what I needed to be doing at that time, I guess, before he was born, is researching this novel. But you research and you read deeply. You anything you can get your hands on about the topic is huge. So I researched very deeply into the history of slavery in the Caribbean in general, but came to focus specifically on Barbados because I found some very, very good texts, including one which was like a memoir that a woman did about the history of her family, mm-hmm. In which she very crisply and on a very granular level details her ancestors actually like breaking ground to build their plantation and goes from there. And when you come across documents that are that particular, I think this is just a trove, and you really have to, you know, you're just so grateful that somebody's given you this bounty. So, you know, in researching the slavery aspects, so obviously this was the most difficult part of the research and the most emotionally draining. And
I can imagine you doing this while pregnant. I mean, that's...
Yeah. So it was, you know, it was emotionally hard. And just the lengths that, you know, reading about the punishments on some of these plantations and the lengths that people went to inflict such cruelty on black bodies. And then having to reproduce that, like having to write about that was equally hard in its own way. But I also did research into historical science. So, you know, the construction of the first flying machines, so hot air ballooning, and also into how people went about cataloging natural specimens in that era, because it was very, obviously very different from today. And once you've done all of that research, which is a process that I do actually while I'm writing the book as well, I'm constantly researching new things because this is part of how the work stays alive to you. It's how you keep getting to that desk every day for the 3-year span of time that it takes you to write the book. But you essentially have to forget about... You have to take all this in, and then you have to set it aside because it's almost like this process of, like, you know what you know, but you don't have to reproduce everything in, you know, exactly as you've read it. You just have to absorb it and then let the characters move through the world. And don't worry about getting everything exactly right, because this is when I think, you know, you get books where it's, the details are accurate, but it's very, very... contrived, like the research is sitting on the surface. So, you know, I think the thing to do is to really focus on the people who are the heart of every story, and then to, you know, where you've gotten details wrong, you can go back and consult your texts afterwards.
And in both of your books, the role of, you could call it fate, you could call it chance, you could call it luck, but it plays a big role. And Tayari, the reason Roy goes to prison is pretty much arbitrary. You know, it's wrong place, wrong time.
Or as his mother says, wrong race at the wrong time.
Ooh. Yeah. And I say the hero of your story, George Washington Black, he's plucked out of the field. He's a field slave, and he's put on a completely different path by Titch, the brother of his owner, just because he happens to be kind of the right size and in his line of view at that moment. So I'd love to hear kind of how you both settle on the role of chance as a plot driver in your work. And, you know, does that have reflections for history or anything else?
I do think that chance plays a role, but one thing I think that we're both doing in our books is that our plots have drivers. Like, I think that when a novel has a busy plot that really engages readers with a lot of twists, chance is one of the things, but it's kind of like how in real life there are no coincidences exactly. Like, Roy goes to prison because he is misidentified. He is misidentified. This is off the page, but it's a shady lineup, which is not exactly chance, right? I mean, he is misidentified by an eyewitness. It was important to me that the eyewitness not be lying exactly. The eyewitness is mistaken. Eyewitness testimony is so tricky because it is at once the most compelling, but also the least reliable. So when eyewitnesses believe themselves to be telling the truth. But I don't think that is really chance. And so, but I think the uncertainty of life is a real driver in this. They're a young couple. They have everything going for them. They think they're engaging in their new life, and like lightning strike, racism strikes him like lightning striking, but lightning only happens when it's raining. So it's not exactly chance, I think.
Right. But just thinking of your novel, like the fact that they decided not to stay at the parents' house, but to go to that hotel, and then to have that particular argument that kind of sends him out of the room, like you really do feel her anguish, that, you know, that she was arguing with him on that evening, and if she had let that go, you know, the course of their whole lives might have been so different. And that was one of the things I really admired about your book.
Well, thank you. I feel like that argument, I get that she feels like she could have let it go, but she probably shouldn't have let it go, because that shouldn't have been let go. And I feel like the circumstances of their lives as black people in America makes it where you're not allowed to argue with your husband about something he fully needs to be argued with about, because the racism might come get him. Like, how can you organize your relationship like that?
And I say, where do I take that? Well, certainly chance does play a huge part in. I'm just going to roll right over that.
You're doing great. You're doing great.
But with Wash, as you said, it is, you know, the course of his whole life is determined by chance, that he is in this man's line of sight. And that he's actually seen by him, because he has a sense of himself as being sort of the shadow being. Like, nobody has actually truly looked at him and seen him. And so when Titch does see him and acknowledges him, this is terrifying for him. He thinks that this is, you know, this is something that will ultimately probably end in his death, this being seen. But it ends up completely reshaping his whole sense of himself, and he begins to see himself as somebody who has contributions to make to the world. But it's a really terrifying moment for him, and it's, as you said, so random. And the fact that he happens to be the right size for ballast, and then Titch starts to acknowledge that maybe, you know, he could actually lend a greater hand in his experimentation process. But I think it really troubles him as he goes out and tries to make his life as a free man into the world, that the fact that he does have these gifts, and that these gifts would have been rendered unrealized without that very random act. And so when he finds himself searching for Titch, as we, you know, later we go deeper into the novel, it's really this, one of the major questions about his origins is this sense of, like, well, why did you choose me? What did you see in me? Was there something very specific, you know, that drew you towards me? Is my, you know, or was it just this random thing? And he really has to grapple with this notion of the fact that, yeah, everything could have been, I guess, snuffed out just like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I also, there's chance that plays a big role, and then there's the idea of freedom in both of your books, which, you know, there's kind of no more important philosophical question for the black diaspora and black writers than, like, what does freedom mean? And Essie, there's a moment in your book when Wash is like, okay, freedom is in sight, but I'm not sure if I want it. And then Tayari, Roy is not free for a big part of an American marriage, and it
becomes clear over the course of the book that Celestial, his wife, is not free either. And I just wanted to know, like, because people come to different definitions of what freedom means in all of these, in both of these books. What did you guys learn about it?
I was struck in Washington Black. There's a moment where, you know, he is offered to go to Canada, where there is freedom. And I've noticed this is something that has come up a lot in narrative of enslaved people, where they're given the opportunity for freedom, but at what cost? Because I think that kind of the way that we think about freedom, particularly for enslaved people, is that to be free of, to live in the free land is the only variable, the only decision make, only decision factor. But when we look at the stories of real life people, like if you think of like Harriet Jacobs, who could have gotten free, but she chose to live in a cramped space so that she would not be apart from her children. Even Sally Hemings, she went to England and she was lured back because her children were enslaved in Virginia. That freedom is more than just the thing we think of as being emancipated. There's more to emancipation than just being outside of the law that says you are property.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, you have to think about, you know, once emancipation was had arrived, that obviously being bodily free does not necessarily mean that you're freed from everything that you'd experience, you know, from the ghosts of everything that that you've experienced, from the pain, from that mode of thinking, from prior attachments of people who maybe are still living lives that are somewhat limited. Freedom is, I think Washington has an idea that of what freedom initially that is very limited and very basic. And this is given him from Big Kit, who is a slave that called a saltwater, meaning that she's known, she was a free woman who was captured and brought across the Atlantic, and so has some idea of what it means to have lived a free life. And she gives him very rudimentary ideas of what freedom is. And she does this because she understands that, how do you describe actual freedom? I mean, it's so hard to quantify. And also, he's a little boy. He's not actually going to understand things in a larger sense. So she tells him that freedom is freedom from human entanglements, and it's freedom, free passage, freedom to roam freely through the world, untethered. And it's freedom from work. If you don't feel like working, you can just kind of, you know, lay down the shovel and walk away. And even those very, very, very basic ideas of freedom are huge for him. Like, this is revolutionary. Just this idea that, you know, you could have some sense of agency over your own time and over your own body. But as he goes out into the world, he recognizes that it's as you've said, that freedom is something that is so complicated and so, you know, he really has to reconstruct what freedom is for for his particular self. And he has to, this includes coming to terms with the fact that there are freedoms that he will never be able to grasp for himself, just because he is, a black man. It's the 1830s. He's disfigured. There are freedoms that will always be beyond what he's able to claim for himself.
I was thinking questions of freedom, because obviously, you know, imprisonment is, you know, being deprived of your freedom, of your liberty. There's a lot of parallels between modern imprisonment in the U.S. and slavery. The people in prison often, you know, they work for pennies an hour, which is the same as working for no pay. The profit is not their own. When they get out, they can't vote. They've been stripped of their citizenship. So I was aware of those kinds of ideas of what it is to be free. But when I was kind of thinking about my character, Roy, Roy, once he gets out of prison, you know, his conviction is overturned. I don't think that's a spoiler because it happens on page 80. Because I did want to get him out of prison as quickly as possible in the story, because I do think his story is most interesting when he is dealing with the consequences of his imprisonment more than the imprisonment itself. But I think that Roy and I both misunderstood what it was that he'd lost. Roy thinks the moral universe of the story and of the other characters is how everyone can help him get what he's lost. He sees regaining his freedom as regaining what he's lost. He feels like he's lost his woman, his job, his car, his status, his standing. And he wants everyone around him to help him to return that to him. Most importantly, he thinks that to regain his marriage is how he can get back what he's lost, like through finding, like, it's like the Odyssey. You know, in the Odyssey, Odysseus wants to come home and find a faithful woman and, like, a clean house. You know, this is what Roy wants as a symbol of his freedom. But, you know, that book was written, like, 85 BC? That was a really long time ago. But he's a modern man with an 85 BC understanding of what should wait him at the end of his terrible trials and tribulations. And so I was stranded 50 pages from the end for a year because I couldn't figure out what to do with that moral universe I had let Roy convince me was the universe of this story. So for a year, I couldn't finish the book. It was like me and the book. We were in a relationship in New York City or in California, and we couldn't afford to move out. But we were broken up, but it was living on my couch. And so I felt like I would wake up in the morning, the book would be on the couch. It wouldn't speak to me. I wouldn't speak to it. I couldn't bring home a new book because this book was on the couch. But it was because I had misunderstood what freedom is. I knew, like, you have a novel about a man who's been wrongfully incarcerated. This is a book about freedom, but I misunderstood what he had lost, so I misunderstood what needed to be returned so that the book could be finished. I realized that what Roy had really lost was his citizenship in his own life. He had forgotten that he had, that in order to be a member of society, to have that returned, he had to remember that he could do something for someone else, that he had something to offer. And when that had been stripped from him, he could never be free. And so once I realized that that was the question, which was, Roy, what can you do for the other people in this story? I was able to finish the book in like less than a week. I could have finished it faster, but I write on typewriters, and my ribbon ran out, and I spent a day and a half trying to get a replacement ribbon. But I was able to just zip through the book because I understood the real question of freedom.
I love that when we started this discussion, you actually used the example of slave women and how the understanding of freedom for them was different. Because one of the things I really wanted to ask both of you is about, you know, the women in both of your books. And Tayari, I mean, the central kind of concern in that book, and I've read so many interviews with you where you talk about, like, you know, I thought this was about Celestial and what she wanted, and the readers wouldn't let me have that. And that I just felt that so much. And I was curious about, like, how you came to an understanding of how to portray her in this book. And then for you, Essie, the women in this book don't have the same freedoms as the men do. And it's very, very clear, especially towards the end, which I'm not going to spoil for anyone. But yeah, I was just hoping the both of you could talk about, you know, femaleness and freedom and how you portrayed the women in your books and how you understood them.
Yeah, so if I think about the women in my books, there are sort of two central characters, and this is Big Kit, who is Washington's protectress on the plantation, and then Tana Goff, mm-hmm. later on in the novel, who is, I hate to say that she's a love interest, because that makes it sound like she was sort of just put there for his, you know, as a foil to him. To me, she's so much more than that. Mm-hmm. But Big Kit is, to me, she's one of the saddest characters in the novel, because she's somebody who she evinces such power. I mean, she's a large woman. She's a tall woman. She's known on the plantation amongst the slaves for her rule of law. Like, everybody is afraid of her. She's somebody who very much inspires, I guess, respect amongst her fellow slaves. And Washington looks to her as this all-powerful figure and has a great sense of faith, but also a great sense of his feelings of being protected a little bit come from her, just because she's looking out for him. But we understand, as we're reading the novel, that she's somebody who has actually no power at all to affect any kind of change in her own life, and certainly over his. She is a little bit coy about her identity with him, and this is in huge part to protect him, because she knows that a day will come when they will be separated, and she can't protect him from that. And so there are moments where she's actually a little bit cruel to him, and this is, you almost think, okay, well, she's remembering this fact that they'll be separated, and she's trying to push him away. And I don't think it's too much of a spoiler to say that the two do get separated when Washington is taken to live with Titch. And we just get this moment of her walking away, and it's there's a real sadness in that, because I think you see that she has been really, he's been removed from his source of love. And, you know, even when he goes out into the world and achieves some measure of freedom, we understand that her path was probably very different from the one that he was allowed to take. And Tana Goff is interesting to me in a different way. She's a biracial woman in a society in which there are very few people like her. And she's very brilliant, but her father is also very brilliant. And she helps him with his scientific research. But her father very much appreciates her mind, but he also sees that she is just a girl. She's just a woman. She's been learning to draw because she wants him to ask her to illustrate one of his scientific tracts. And when we hear him talk about this later, it's just, oh, that's just her doodlings. You know, he doesn't take her seriously, even though he sees that she's obviously very gifted. And I think that's, you know, very symptomatic of how women were seen back then, especially when it came to playing an intellectual role in society, that this was not a place that they were allowed to occupy. And so that's another kind of estrangement from power, I guess, a way that she's being removed from having any kind of power.
I think that is one. I'm going to be very careful so there are no spoilers, but I think that's a plot device we have across our books, this revealing of identity. I noticed, but I won't say anything else. But you know what I'm talking about. I was interested very much in the collateral effects of incarceration and the way that it affects gender dynamics, particularly in the African-American community. They call it mass incarceration because it happens to a lot of people. And so it is, the idea of prison is such, just becomes such a part of the culture. I'm a professor at Emory University, and I'm a full professor. And I doubt very seriously that my white colleagues who are also full professors know how to put money on someone's commissary who's in prison. I know how to do this. I've known how to do this a long time. It's because it's such just a part of the culture. I have a number of pen pals who are in prison, and I write them letters, and they don't strike me as different than my other pen pals, because prison is just such a part, it's woven into the culture. But I was wondering, though, how then does it affect, particularly, say, marriages? Celestial and Roy only married 18 months when he's wrongfully in prison. And like I said, he went to prison because they had an ordinary argument that should be completely, a person should be completely free to have that level of argument in your marriage. It wasn't the end of the world, but it was just, you know, they're young lovers. But it seemed to me that in the face of incarceration, you know how, like, when you're growing up and you're Black, people tell you, oh, you have to be twice as good, you have to be three times as good to get half as much. Well, this is even true in their marriage. For their marriage to have survived his imprisonment, they would have to be super couple. To have a marriage, which is not all that, you know, it's a mundane thing. All kinds of random people are married. I bet it's a whole bunch of random married people in this room, right? But they would have had to have been extraordinary to have stayed married. And then the question of the expectation of her. They're married 18 months, and they have, you know, an average marriage. It's a little bumpy. It's passionate. It's sometimes it's on the rocks. And she's expected to wait for him for 12 years, and they've been married 18 months. And her fidelity to him is seen as her fidelity to the race, the struggle, the cause. And so her individual decisions, it now seems like what happened to Roy, her husband, happened because of an injustice involving the state. But this one woman's chastity is seen to be equal to the wrongs of the state. That's a lot for a woman to be the moral indicator like that. And she's successful. She's an artist. Her career is happening. She wants from her life the same things many of us want from our lives. But she can't want that. Like all the challenges that face modern women, like she says about her career. She says, I don't like using the word career because it sounds like bitch is hiding between the letters. This is more the case for her because of her husband's struggle. There's more guilt for her to be ambitious. It seems like everything that she achieves is at his expense. Even though that's not true, it's the way that it's perceived. And so when she decides that she wants her own life, her own father turns against her because he's looking to her as symbolic of upholding the struggle. And this is something, I feel like everything that happens with Celestial and Roy, it's the same thing that happens to everyone else, but for them, it's turned up. The heat is turned up. And in preparing to write this, I started reading all these, looking for novels about women who were dissatisfied in marriages for various reasons. And I had a hard time finding novels about Black women who are leaving marriages. Only way I could find a novel about a Black woman leaving a marriage is that the marriage had to be a nightmare. She had to be running for her life. It had to be violent. It just had to be just untenable. But I read novels by white women, upper middle class white women. They're leaving marriages because they just weren't feeling it. Like they wanted to be sculptors or whatever. And, you know, they wanted to go eat and pray and love, you know, not necessarily in that order. But when you read these books, you're like, yes, girl, go eat, go pray, go love. But when the Black women, it could never just be for fulfillment. It always, because I realized the difference was that in the novels about white women, if she left the husband or left the marriage, there was no sense that he was in trouble. There was no sense that she was the only thing holding something larger together. That her individual decision to be free, to use your word, was just one person getting free. And aren't we all in favor of freedom? But when it came to the Black woman, her freedom seemed to come at the expense of others. And I've had so many people, like this woman in Baltimore, I thought this woman was going to come up on the stage for me over this matter. She was just screaming at me. She kept saying, you stand by your man. And whenever I would try to change the subject, she would stand up and kind of like shake her cane at me. And she was like, you stand by that man. And I realized, one, I had never been heckled before. And most of my colleagues have never been heckled. But when I was bringing up this idea of Black female autonomy, it brings up a lot of strong feelings. Ooh.
I'd like to thank all of you for being a well-behaved audience today.
It's not over.
I want to make sure that I ask both of you about the form of your books and kind of the creative decisions you made with them. Tayari, one of the things that I don't think has gotten enough attention about An American Marriage is that it's an epistolary novel, and you wrote it in 2018, and this is a form that has not been popular since the 19th century. And it works. And I'm really, really interested in how you chose that and how you decided it could be updated. And then I say the thing that's amazing about Washington Black, when I was reading it, I was thinking, you know, it's this very old-fashioned novel, and I mean that in the best way. It's like Don Quixote, you know, you've got this hero on a journey going through these different landscapes, and it's just, but it is like, it's not fashionable, and I just am interested in how you decided that this was the right way to tell that story.
I think the material just wanted to be what it wanted to be. You know, I always hate it when writers talk about, oh, it just, you know, it's just intuitive. I just had to do it that way because it seems so nebulous. But I think I'm maybe a writer who's never been interested in writing to a fashion and maybe not even really being aware of what a current trend is. I read a lot of books, a lot of older books. I do read contemporary literature, but it's all sort of, you know, I read everything. And so I think part of what I was trying to do with the novel is to play with, I guess, the structure of a slave narrative and the voice of a slave narrative, but also to... Obviously, you can't structure things the way that they're structured kind of in the past because, you know, we have kind of... people are very, you know, looking for sophistication in their narratives. People have a very different way of reading now. And so, you know, I was very aware of that as well. But I wanted to play with that... Yeah, that kind of feeling of a recorded voice from a slave narrative, but also to play with these ideas of Dickensian, I guess a sense of, I don't want to say fanciful, but fullness and richness, and this sense that a story can be an outward thing. And because I think a lot of fiction nowadays can be very interior. We're thinking, you know, we're dealing with a lot of thought. And it's much less fashionable to write something where everything is exteriorized and we have this, you know, people going places and we're maybe not as privy to their thoughts. And so I really wanted to have a balance of that, a balance of you know, us being privy to the character's thoughts and his emotions as he's going through all of these things, but also to impress on the story a sense of adventure and to have the reader feel a sense of wonder, I guess, as they're reading this, because this is akin to what Wash would be feeling as he's going out into the world. I mean, this is somebody who even to step off that plantation is a miraculous thing. So I wanted the reader to really be feeling this sense of excitement and possibility about the greater world, and this is why things are kind of pushed to the very edge.
And I think it's a classic. I don't think it's. It may be unfashionable, but it's also classic. Like, that's a classic kind of storytelling. And people still read Huck Finn. They still read that. I mean, it may not be in style and what's being published right now, but I think it's in style with the things that are read right now. I think it's evergreen. I loved it. I just couldn't stop flying through the pages when I read it.
Thanks.
Shoot, I forgot the question. What were we at? Oh, storm, story, letters, epistolary. Okay. I have always wanted to write an epistolary novel. There was a very popular epistolary novel in the 80s, The Color Purple. Right. Yes, and evergreen, still read. I think that I always wanted to write an epistolary novel, and prison is one of the last contexts in which you can write the letters and it seem organic and not like you just wanted to include letters, because letters are very important. People in prison value letters for three reasons, right? They value the letter for the information contained in the letter. They just want to know what it is you're sending them. Secondly, every letter is a gift because of the time, et cetera, that it takes. So it's a gesture. And thirdly, the letter is valued as a physical artifact. It can be kept. You know, the person can keep it with them in their living quarters. They can reread it. They have it. It's a gift. So letters are super valuable. When I was doing a piece for the Times about the recently collected volume of Mandela's prison letters. You also can see in his letters, which is true here in the U.S., how the mail is used to manipulate people in prison. Sometimes your mail will just, it'll be read, it'll be censored, it'll be destroyed. Your mail could be sent back. I sent a card to one of my pen pals for his birthday. And you know, if you shop at Papyrus, the little fancy cards, they put that little gold sticker on the back with the hummingbird. The letter was returned to me and it had a note on it saying, no stickers. You know, just to be punitive, because the mail is so important. It is used to manipulate. And also, letters in the story, the way the story works, is that prison is two things. Prison is brutality and prison is monotony. And when you read a novel, you experience vicariously what the characters experience, and the same for writing it. And I did not want you as a reader or me as a writer to experience monotony or brutality, but I wanted to capture that essence of the prison experience. So when Roy and Celestial communicate only through his letters, he curates his experiences for her. So we only experience what he wants her to experience, and he doesn't tell her everything. But in my research, I was looking for small details that capture what I call like the minutiae of deprivation, so you could feel what happened to him with and being spared the blow by blow.
I want to make sure one of the things, and you've kind of seen this on stage, but you guys are fans of each other's work, which is so lovely, and I wanted to make sure that you had an opportunity to ask each other a question.
I want to ask you about writing the child's perspective. Oftentimes when people experience traumatic things, the first thing people say is, oh, you know, his childhood was stolen. He was never a child. And I feel like when people say that, they're depriving the character of or the person, if it's a real person, a character, if it's a fictive person, of an essential part of their humanity. So I would love to you to tell me a little bit about how you chose to make this a coming of age.
Yeah, I think it would be a very different novel if it were told from the perspective of Washington when he was, you know, say, 30 years old. the whole tenor of it would be very different. I think in choosing, having him be 11 years old, this came directly out of my source material from the Tichborne case. This was the exact age at which Andrew Bogle was stolen off his plantation. So that's where that came from. But I also think that his being a child gives him kind of like this extra layer of, there's like a double vulnerability there, that he's completely somebody without defenses. You know, he doesn't quite understand the way the world around him operates. He's got a kind of... as I said, like a double vulnerability. But that's also that extra layer of vulnerability. It's like a protection in a way, too, because he doesn't really understand exactly what's at stake and, like, truly deeply feel, you know, the fact that when he's escaping, if this doesn't go well, that there will be a very unpleasant death at the end of this. It's like he knows it on a very... sort of nebulous, abstract level, but he doesn't really, he's not really engaging with that. And so, you know, I really wanted to, I guess, show the psychology of what it meant to come of age in, you know, within these conditions, and also what it would mean to come of age while you were also being allowed to exercise more personal freedoms, and that was interesting to me, that kind of intersection between these two periods of great change.
And I feel like it tempers the experience, too, for the reader. And because he's learning his world, we're also learning his world along with him. I feel like it helped pull me in, I think, with this, you know, this very young character who is... I guess we are all experiencing history, but I think that when we read something set so far in the past, we're aware of the character as a historical subject, I think.
Yeah, that sounds good. I have actually several questions for you. So, but the first is, I was really intrigued by the use of dolls. Like, Celestial creates these these dolls that resemble people in her life, and they're very intricate, and they become, you know, almost very symbolic within the text. Like, was there kind of a basis for these dolls? Have you seen dolls like these in real life?
I have a friend who makes dolls. She makes these really beautiful, elaborate dolls. And I've always intrigued by her work. One, because I'm not good with my hands. So it's always something so impressive when you see someone do something that you simply cannot do. But one thing there's so many things about her as a doll maker that are intriguing to me. One is that she could spend years on one doll. And when she finished it, no matter how careful it is, how elaborate, how many historical references she may make in what the doll is wearing or how the doll is constructed, people regard it as, oh, that's cute. That's something for little girls. And I think that's true for women artists. So I was looking at that way. Like, I'll be on a plane and the person next to me will say, so what do you do? And I'll say, oh, I'm a writer. And he says, oh, have you written a romance novel? And I'll say, no, I've written a novel about the collateral effects of wrongful incarceration. And he'll say, oh, that's great. I'll buy that for my wife. Like, he has me on a certain track, you know, in his mind. So that was one thing I was interested in with Celestial as a doll maker. But I was also interested in what I call the ethics of portrait making, in that, you know, even as writers, you know, sometimes we are inspired by people we know in real life and we may capture some of their characteristics in a story. Sometimes they like it, sometimes they don't. And where are the lines? Like Roy, he loves that she makes the dolls like him when they're first married. You know, he's like, oh, I'm her muse. You know, he's so proud of that. But once he is imprisoned and she's getting attention and success and even money for the dolls like him, he feels like she's stealing his story for her art. So where do we draw the line? What do we owe one another? And also, I was just interested in the idea. There's so much conversation about babies in this book. Everyone's talking about, you know, babies, reproduction, and I like the dolls symbolically in that way.
No, that's fascinating. I loved that idea of the use of dolls. It's, you know, it's almost like having this doll that looks like him as a baby, it's like this proxy for him. It's like he's still with her in the form of a doll. It was really, really interesting. I was on a panel last week, I guess, and somebody asked me, the interviewer asked, whether I like kept talismans on my desk when I was writing, if there was something, you know, very particular or special that I had on my desk that, you know, I could look to when I was struggling. And kind of thought about this, because I don't have a ton of stuff. But then, no, I don't. But then somebody said, oh, I just interviewed Tayari. And she said that you're a big Toni Morrison fan. Is this correct? Well, this is probably an understatement, right?
I don't even think
right?
fan is fan strong is, enough
it doesn't
for
cover
devotee.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, I am too. And so I was so envious to hear that. I guess you had a student who went to Toni Morrison's hometown.
To Lorain, Ohio.
Yep. You take it away.
Brought me back some dirt from the lawn of the house. And I keep it in a little baby food jar on my desk and I shake it. And if I have a student that's having a really hard time and I really, really like that student, I'll give them a little pinch. Because I think that Earth is magical. It's, you know, it's where we are. What is your favorite Morrison novel?
Beloved.
Of course, of course. You know, I lean towards Song of Solomon, but sometimes I think I'm just being contrary. I don't know. But, I mean, Toni Morrison, the thing about Morrison that is amazing is the way, well, there's so many things, so many. But the way she can take the lives of regular people and raise them where they feel, like to raise them to the level of myth, while keeping their kind of down-home ways about them. Like, she doesn't change them. She doesn't change them to raise them. She changes us to understand who they are.
Mm, that's beautifully put. And just on a sentence level, even, like, just the great singing in her lines is just, you know, I hadn't read kind of a lot of contemporary novels that did this when I came across her work, and I hadn't read a lot of like black female novelists. I think just, you know, having been born and raised in Western Canada, I wasn't exposed to this in the school system. So I was just, it was like, a bomb going off in my life to come across Beloved and I read it every
day. And Morrison is kind of funny. I think people don't give her enough credit for the humor that's in her work as well. The people often, in the face of great adversity, you know, they make jokes, they wisecrack, and I love about Morrison that the people make jokes and they laugh, but it's not this sense. You know how people say, oh, when you're having a hard time, you have to laugh to keep from crying? I think that is kind of demeans the humanity of the people. They laugh because it's funny, too. You know, it's not like you laugh because you're so miserable. It's that you laugh because you're a full human being.
Okay, it is time for the audience Q&A portion. And over here, you're going to see a gentleman with a microphone. So when you have a question, you're going to head over towards him. And I do want to set a couple of ground rules. The first ground rule is that you need to speak directly into the microphone because we're recording this and we want to get your question. And then the second part is make sure that your question is in the form of a question. If you have a comment, this is not the forum for that. All right.
Thank you. My question is, did you enjoy the research you did? And if I can sneak in a comment.
I don't know. How short is the comment?
Really short.
All right.
I'm a historian, and I'm a great admirer of both books, and especially of the way that you both used research with such an extraordinary mastery of language and plot. Thank you.
Well, that is Nell Painter, I should tell you. I did not enjoy the research. I'm such a hardcore fiction writer that I feel hemmed in by the truth. Like, when I find something out, I'm like, oh, shoot, now that I know that, that means this plot idea I had won't work. Like, often I feel like the research was doing checks and balances on my imagination, but I knew that it was important. So I did it, but I didn't dig it.
I love research. Like, it, you know, if I could, I seriously would just research year after year if I wasn't, you know, under contract and had to actually sit down and produce something. So, but obviously the subject matter made for difficult research at times, and it was, you know, there were days when I did have to sort of put things down and walk away from my desk and go for a walk just because it was quite grim reading. But, you know, I got a lot of pleasure reading about historical scientific practices and botany and also the construction of, like, flying machines. This was a lot of fun. And, you know, there's a... an amazing trove of research online, like to find the exact diving suit from that era. You know, I just was combing online, and there are all these diving suit nerds who have all these sites with pictures, and yeah, that was a great pleasure to do that.
Any others?
Hi, thank you so much. Besides each other's work, and besides Toni Morrison, who are you currently reading?
I'm currently reading, I just started reading, I don't know how to pronounce her name, it's a Norwegian name. Is it Asne Seierstad? Her book on the Norwegian, the massacre with Anders Breivik. So I just started reading that. It's like a 600-page book about, I guess, gives like a history of Norway at the time that he was born and walking our way up to the massacre. It's, I think it's very fascinating, and I think it's required reading, I think, for everybody, no matter the nation. What are you reading?
You know, I find myself reading a lot of books that aren't out yet. You know, because they get sent to me in galley form, and it's kind of frustrating because when I'm reading it, no one else has read it, and then by the time everyone else has read it, I kind of forgot about it. But I'm reading a book that's not out yet, but it's so good. Write it down. It's called A Mighty Justice. It's a memoir by Dovie Rowntree, who was a lawyer in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, a black woman, and she represented a lot of minor cases that attacked Plessy versus Ferguson, which ultimately led, you know, to Brown versus the board. But I was not aware before I read this book about all these lawyers who were just constantly bringing cases on behalf of people who resisted segregation. I feel like history makes us think that one day in Montgomery, Rosa Parks decided not to get up. And even when history corrects itself, it lets us know that this was an orchestrated moment of civil disobedience. But I did not know that people every day were refusing to give up their seats, were trying to eat in, you know, segregated cars on trains, and suffered great, you know, they were beaten, they were in prison, and there were all these lawyers, and the lawyers were like lawyering by day, working at the post office at night, bringing these cases, almost all of which were unsuccessful. So like television shows us these lawyer dramas, and the lawyers are so well dressed and they win their cases and they go on to win another case, but they were just constantly being defeated in the courts, and they just kept coming back. It's so good. It's called A Mighty Justice. And I would be remiss if I did not mention that the lawyer that it's about, she is a graduate of Spelman College in Atlanta, which is my alma mater.
Ms. Jones, my book group is discussing your book Tuesday night. We're a bunch of old white guys.
It happens.
And is there anything in particular that you would hope that we as a group have taken away from this book? And second, would you like to come?
Is there going to be food?
Absolutely.
Okay, we'll talk about that. But I think, you know, I often think about, like, what is the most important thing about this book? Like, my guess is that if you're reading this book, the question of wrongful incarceration, I mean, you know it's wrong. That's why they call it that, right? That's why they call it wrongful incarceration. So I was supposed to know that already, but I think that what I hope that you go away with is an understanding of the way that this affects every person in the family, in the community, the ripple effects, because that's what I was really mostly interested in. And also that every time any person is put in prison, that is a family separation. And every person in prison, sometimes people ask me, oh, how did you write a love story involving prison? But every person in prison is in a love story because everyone is loved by someone. So if your book group walks away with greater empathy for incarcerated people and their family, I would be honored.
Ms. Jones, I'm an old white guy too, and we're also reading your book in a mixed group. But I was actually listening to this book and driving, and I came across a line, and I just burst into tears when I read it. And there are a couple lines. Says, I'm ready, but I can't lie. Sometimes I feel guilty as hell for just being able to live my life. And then you say, there should be a word for this. The word it feels to steal something that's already yours. Comment on that and where that came from?
You know, thank you for such a close read. I think that I was thinking about the way that as a person that is aware of anything, aware of any of the injustices, whether they are happening to someone in your family or just in society, there is a certain kind of survivor guilt that comes from just being aware of how much other people suffer and a feeling of why have I been spared this? Like, because these things that happen, like as a culture, it's all tied up. Like we, all of us have privilege, and in the face of others who don't have it, how can you justify taking pleasure in your own life when someone so close by is suffering so greatly? And it's a balancing act, right? Because if you are not affected by the pain of others, are you human? But how do you claim the one life that is yours at the same time? I felt like this was the emotional conflict, you know, at the center, you know, of this story. How do any of us have a right to be happy?
Thank you.
Thank you both very much. And I can relate to is tears, and I can relate to rage. Because in reading both of your books, there were times when I was so tearful. There were times when I couldn't read anymore. And my husband encouraged...
I'm sorry, could you speak directly into the microphone?
Sure. I was encouraged to read, especially Washington Black, to finish it. Because I just could not take the pain anymore, and I was encouraged to finish the book, and I'm glad I did, but oh, it was so painful. The emotion that I feel when I read your books, and I say to myself, I'm only reading it, and it's in a fictional matter, but I know that people lived this way, so if they endure what they did, I can read your book. But thank you both very much.
I'm bringing up a question about what you think about some of the restrictions about middle school books. A friend of mine in Florida was incarcerated at age 13, tried as an adult, and he's been in prison for 30-some years. And in the books that, the current book that I'm writing, a middle school book about a character who's incarcerated and the problems her Hispanic family deals with, I've been told that it's too heavy for 12-year-olds, 13-year-olds. And I wondered if you would care to comment about that.
Okay, I'll do it. Well... And I don't write for that audience. I do know there are a lot of more restrictions on books for young people. I do think with books for young people, there is a sense that, don't you feel like there's a sense that there's more gatekeeping or more shepherding because it's like the youth are at stake in a way that books for adult readers are not. Do you think that there is a such thing as a book that's inappropriate for a young reader?
I mean, probably there is, but I also think that we tend to not trust that our children can be exposed to and have an interest in difficult material. I think it's a fallacy that, you know, there's certain subject matter that, you know, that children... Like, for instance, I'm trying to think of a case of a book that was about, I think it was about the Holocaust, and that, you know, there was a particular school in my region that didn't want people to be reading this book. Actually, I think it was that Judy Blume book. Do you know the one where...
Dear God, it's me, Margaret?
So this was very...
Ellie Weisel's Night has also been banned a couple of times. That's about a Holocaust survivor's memoir.
Yeah, and I think that what, you know, having read both of those books, I think that this is appropriate material to expose to the age group that you're saying. I think what needs to happen is a contextualization of that material and a discussion around it that, I guess that's age appropriate, and that would allow children to enter the material with a certain sense of, you know, that doesn't protect them from it, but gives them a context that, like I said, is age appropriate. I don't think it should be off limits, though.
And don't you think there is, with kids, there's sanctioned reading and unsanctioned reading? Like, I know that I was a child, there were books that were like teacher and librarian sanctioned reading, and then there was the good stuff, and there was like a certain thrill you got at like reading off the adult shelf. So I actually do think there are books that I read and benefited from as a child that were not sanctioned and probably shouldn't have been sanctioned, but I also should have read it. So I think that's also part of the exploration of coming to read, you know, as a young person.
Okay, we've got time for one last question, and it looks like we've got it. All right.
Hi, you all. Thank you so much for your work. A huge fan of both of you. My question is kind of twofold. As you're writing these stories, do you have a moment where there's a resistance towards writing about the interiority of your characters' lives? And what advice do you have for young Black women, upcoming writers? Thank you.
Take it away.
Sorry, can you rephrase your first question? Was about writing?
So, like, facing the resistance or any kind of resistance around writing about the interior nature of people's lives that maybe you don't want to come out or something that feels personal, but just interiority, does that scare you, bother you, create resistance?
Right. You know, it has never scared me. I have friends who are writers who draw a lot from their actual lives. I have a writer friend she's actually incapable of even changing the real name of the person from whom she's, just because that name expresses the essence of who that person is, she feels, and that's a very dangerous way to write, I would think. She seems to have gotten away with it so far, but I worry for her. I think the goal of writing any character-driven novel is to express every facet of that life. And, you know, this includes, I guess, just everything of the personal. You know, their sexual thoughts and their prejudices, just everything. And I think you just have to lay it out on the page you know, even if it's something that might at some point repulse a reader, to give a full picture of who that person is and what that life was, I think you have to just bear everything. And I guess that would feed into my advice for young Black female novelists, is that it's such a cliche to say write your truth, but I think, you know, there's something to it, is to write from your experience and write from I guess from your interests. Not be afraid and not shy away from something that you're deeply interested in, just because you think it won't prove, I guess, sellable, in a sense. You have to ignore that and just write from your passions, and your interests.
I did feel, when I was writing An American Marriage, a little boxed in at one point with the character of Roy, because, you know, he's a Black man, he's been wrongfully accused of a sexual assault. Everything about him felt so symbolic, you know, because his problem was so archetypal. And so every time I would make a decision with his character, it's like I could hear a voice saying, "So what then are you trying to say about the experience of capital the Black man?" And the way that I remedied it is that I added another male point of view character. Because just like in real life, when you're the only one in the room, you feel like all your decisions reflect on everyone else and you can't fully be yourself because the burden of shared representation. So just by adding the second male voice, Andre, it gave both of them more room to be themselves and relieve some of the pressure from me of trying to make them representative. And that was I think it improved the book, and wasn't a very difficult fix. So I find that if I'm having some kind of, when you have a problem like that, you can either not worry about your character seeming representative, or you can do something to change that dynamic, whichever works best for the story. As for my advice to you, it's going to be surprising perhaps, but my advice to you is to, of course, write your story, but you know what? People always tell writers that you have to write every day. You know, they say that a writer writes every day. I think that's not, first off, they're lying. They're not writing every day. But but it's important to me that I tell you that you don't have to write every day, because a lot of people have busy, full lives that keep them from writing every day. We don't, most of us work, for example. People work. People have children. People have elder care. People have responsibilities. If we say that the writing is only done by the people who have the leisure to sit and write every day, then what are the stories that will be told? The very reasons that make it where you cannot write every day are the things that are going to make your writing important, because you're living a busy, meaningful life. So I say don't write every day, but I will say, this is not letting you off the hook, write often. I write about 3 times a week. I feel like when other people are in the gym, that's when I write. And I think that's enough.
So I would, I'd like to thank Tayari and Essa. You guys are both amazing. I'd like to thank the audience, and I want to encourage all of you to buy their books, and you can do it right outside. Pegasus Books has a table set up. They will be signing. This is your opportunity. Buy lots of books. Give them out to your family members. All right.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the Bay Area Book Festival. For more information and podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.